Make sure you show all of your work in the derivation of the solution. Don't just write down the solution.
Is there no initial condition?
No initial condition. I'll be shy about joining the group.
Yeah, perfect. Then it would be.
Yeah.
That one. Because once you get the negative and then you all the opposite values.
What are we talking about? Homework two?
No. All homework papers are right here. There's 2 points here.
Okay, also no staples or paper clips.
No staples.
Okay, so let's wrap it up in about a minute or so. Make sure that you all agree on the answer and the work. And you're showing all your work, right? So show how you found the integrating factor and how you use the integrating factor to get the solution. Okay, so let's go ahead and I'm going to work it and then you're going to hand in the quiz. So, mu is equal to e to the integral, negative 2 over t dt, which becomes e to the
negative 2
ln t, which is what? So, one step at a time, so e to the ln of t to the negative 2, which becomes then what? T to the negative 2. So that's our integrating factor. Now I need to see every step. Okay, you guys get in the habit of showing your work. Now maybe you could go from here to here, but I prefer that you show this intervening step as well, because otherwise I'm not sure that you really know what you're doing. And these quizzes are supposed to help you, first of all, see the amount of work that you need to show on these problems, practice writing this stuff down a little bit, and also solving the problem in kind of a comfortable atmosphere. Okay, so then what do we do with the mu?
Multiply
the equation all the way through by the mu, so we get t to the negative 2 times y prime minus 2 over t cubed. I could write that as 2 times t to the negative 3 times y is equal to 1. Now, presumably, the left-hand side is equal to d by dt of mu, which is t to the negative 2, times y. So it's always going to be mu y here. But you want to take this opportunity to check your work to make sure that you've done this right. So you get the first times the derivative of the second plus the second times the derivative of the first, and the derivative of the first with respect to t is negative 2 t to the negative 3, which is exactly this. And so now we multiply both sides by dt, so you get t to the negative 2 times y is equal to, actually there's a d here, is equal to dt, and now we're going to integrate both sides, and the integral of dt is what?
t plus c.
That's where you get your arbitrary constant for the solution. And the integral of the differential here, d just you're left with t to the negative 2 times y, and that's equal to t plus c. And we're getting close here, so multiply both sides by t squared, so you get y is equal to t cubed plus c t squared, and that should be your solution. Okay, so let's go ahead and turn in the quiz. Just passing forward.
Oh, my bad. Wrong paper.
What? Yeah, you don't want to hand in the cover sheet for the homework. Okay. Quiz. Thank you. We got everybody's quiz? Okay. And let me go ahead and hand out the sign-in sheet. Everybody's here tonight, I think, but I always like to have a record of the signatures, and that way if there's any question whether you were here or not, at least I have a record of it. Also, what I want to do is we have a request from the SAS office for someone in here who would be happy to share their notes with a fellow student. And you need to go through me to do that. But if you think you're a good note taker, so if you take thorough notes and they're readable, then SAS is willing to pay you $100 for the semester, but you've got to get past me. I need to see your notes from the last few weeks, whatever, the last couple of weeks, whatever this is. This is the third week now, I guess. So if you take good notes, come up after class, and if you want the $100, and then I'll give you the form. If there's multiple of you, well, you guys can share the responsibility, or you can go down and negotiate with SAS. Okay, does that make sense? Okay. And if you haven't turned in your homework, please do so before you leave. I know there are a couple of you that haven't yet done it because you came in late and you were working on the quiz. So that's okay. Just make sure that you turn in your homework before you leave. Use the cover sheet here. Make sure your name's on the cover sheet. Okay, so any questions before we get started? Was there any question about the quiz? I think the way we do it, there shouldn't be too many, but if you do have one, I'm happy to talk about it some more before I erase it. Okay, so I'm going to erase the quiz. So this week we're doing 2-4, 2-5, 2-6, and we did 2-4 and pretty much most of 2-5 on Tuesday. And so we're going to finish up 2-5 tonight and then do 2-6. I think we can finish it tonight. And then we have an exam next Thursday in class. So be sure that you budget your time and get here by the start of class on Thursday so you have the full time to work on the test. And you should really start studying now for it if you haven't already. Okay, so I wanted to do, I think this was even in the first homework, or someone's asked me about this question. This is actually problem number 2 in 2.5. And this is that so-called Gumpert's equation. So let me just write it on the board. And so dy dt is equal to r times y times ln of k over y And we're told that 0 less than or equal to y less than or equal to, actually, y is strictly greater than 0, and y is less than or equal to k. And we also know that r is greater than 0 and k is greater than 0. So, and there are three parts to this. I'm going to do the first two parts. The third part, I would just graph the f of y with respect to y for the, actually, is that, it turns out it's the same, I think it, there was a different section that had the same problem in it, but just, you can show this graphically, so that's part C, so we're not going to worry about that. But part A is graph the f of y versus y. And now, you know, a lot of you are going to go straight to the handheld calculator and, you know, the graphing calculator, and you're just going to graph it, and then you're not going to think anything more about it. But I think it's a good idea to get in the habit of trying to graph these things without a graphing calculator. And it, I know there's a lot of resistance there because, like, in this world, we have all this technology, we ought to use it, but, you know, one day you guys are going to be replaced by robots if you don't know how to do basic math. And one of the basic things is to be able to graph something like this. If we call this f of y, so can we plot this as a function of y? Well, it's not that hard. I mean, as first of all, we're limited to y's between 0 and k. So let's look at this. So let's say k is here. And what's going to happen if k, let's say y is less than k, then, and you know, k could be some big number, and we, but it doesn't really matter what it is. But so this could be some number, but then we're taking the logarithm of something that's less than 1. So, greater than 1.
Not always greater than 1.
Yeah, that's right. It's always greater than 1 for this. So this is going to be positive, and this is going to be positive, and so your f of y is going to be positive. So we know it's going to be somewhere in the first quadrant. Right? Now, what happens when y is equal to k? Yeah, so if y is equal to k, then you get ln of 1, which is 0, and 0 times anything is 0. So it's gonna do something like that. It's going to come down, and it's going to hit 0. And when y is greater than k, then you get a negative, and that's why this thing is going to go, it's going to go south. So it's going to, it does something like that. And now the other thing that you have to look at is what happens as y goes to 0. Now again, you can just look at a graphing calculator, but I will challenge you on that graphing calculator thing. And I'll just skip to the conclusion here. The calculator is going to tell you that it looks like it's going to 0. My question to you is it really 0?
It's undefined.
Is it undefined? There's this thing called limits. Do you guys remember limits?
So we need to use L'Hopital's rule there then?
Absolutely. Of course. So here's what's going to happen. If you say, well, it goes to 0, and you don't prove that it goes to 0, then my question is, how do you know it goes to 0? Oh, because I looked at the graphing calculator. So what are you going to do? Are you going to make the window, you know, zoom in on this thing and go all the way down to, like, really tiny numbers and verify that it goes to 0? That's the question. That's the level of discipline that I want you to bring to the mathematical problem. You should be able to tell me, does it go to 0 or not? Or maybe it goes to 1 over 1,000. And how are you going to do that? Now, somebody said L'Hopital's rule. Okay, that's great. So, can we apply L'Hopital's rule directly?
You have to modify it.
How?
You have to put one of the y's above or below.
Okay, so why is that?
Because it's to be 0 over 0.
Yeah, that's it. So, very good. So, L'Hopital only works if it's the limit of a function that's either 0 over 0 or infinity over infinity. Or infinity over negative infinity, or something like that. So, now as y goes to 0, you're going to have some number here divided by 0, which is a big number, but the logarithm of a big number is a big number. But this is going to be a small number. So this is infinity, and this is 0. So you have 0 times infinity. So what are you going to do then? So then one way we could do this is we could say, okay, this is R ln K over Y divided by 1 over Y. And now we can take the limit as Y goes to 0. And so limit as Y goes to 0 plus, because we don't want Y to get negative, of, and I'm going to factor the R out, so R and then ln k over y, 1 over y. Now we can apply L'Hopital's rule, which is equal to r times what?
The derivative.
The derivative of the top divided by the derivative of the bottom. Well, what's the derivative of the top? Well, it's 1 over k divided by y, so it's y over k, times what?
The derivative
of the inside, which is k times, so this is y to the negative 1, and the derivative of that is negative 1 times y to the negative 2. And that's your upstairs derivative. What's your downstairs derivative? Well, this is y to the negative 1, so you get negative y to the negative 2. And just making sure. I haven't made any mistakes yet, right? Okay, so that looks good. So I can cancel these, and so we get, and these k's cancel, and so we get our y limit as y goes to 0 of r y, which is equal to which is equal to 0. I should have written the limit here too. Okay, so it just proved that it goes to 0. So it's positive somewhere in here and it goes to 0. Okay, and now we know for sure that it does that. Okay. Now that's the first part. That's part A. Any questions on this? Yes?
In the graph one, do we need to put a whole of 0?
Yeah, I mean, that's fine. It's strictly, so y has to be strictly greater than 0. They tell you that, so I don't think it matters.
And it wouldn't go down past k, would it?
No, that's true, because you can't have y greater than k, but that's, you know, that's what it would do if y was allowed to be greater than k. Yes?
Why do you take the limit as y goes to 0 again?
Because I don't believe that you can tell from the graphing calculator that it goes to 0. So I'm saying,
why do you take the limit? Wait, so we're going to do that way? That's why.
This is the y. So we're going in this direction, getting closer to the origin. Other questions? Now this is actually fun, right? This is what you got into engineering to do. Did you have a question?
Yeah.
Well, this y. So forget about the r for a moment. You got y ln of k over y. And this is equal to 1 over 1 over y times ln of k over y. Because 1 over 1 over y is y. Right? And so now I just put the 1 over y underneath. Okay? Yes?
Dumb question, but how do you take the derivatives of ln of k over y again?
Okay, so d by dy of ln of k over y is equal to. So it's derivative of ln u is what? 1 over u? So it's 1 over k over y times the derivative of the inside, which is k times the derivative of y to the negative 1, which is negative y to the negative 2. So then I just flip this and say 1 over k over y is just y over k. Okay? Other questions? Okay, so that's part A. Now part B says, and this is all good practice. You know, some of you might need a little bit of a review of your L'Hopital's rule and differentiation formulas and things like that, because we're going to definitely need that stuff later on in the course, even right now in the course. So next, part B says, where is the derivative maximum? Now, if you look at this, so what's happening? If we drew the phase line diagram, which is, this is the phase line diagram, but we only have to be concerned about from 0 to k, so it's increasing. Well, if this is k, then it's going to look something like this, right? So the derivative goes to 0 at k, so it tapers off, and we're not told exactly where the time origin is, so it could be that, it could do this.
The axis for that is y.
This is t, and this is y. Okay? So, but notice there's an inflection point here. And the question that's really being asked is what value of y is where that inflection point occurs. So it's concave up here, but then it's concave down here. So where does that switch in concavity occur? No, not necessarily. You can't assume that it's in the center.
Take the second derivative.
Well, this is already the first derivative. So this is the function that we're looking at is f of y. So we take the first derivative of f of y and set that equal to 0 and solve. So let's do that over here. Right, this is just a review of basic calculus, but this is the kind of stuff, these tools that you need occasionally to solve these problems. So here's our function, and we're going to take the derivative with respect to y of that function, r y ln k over y, and set it equal to 0. So let's do the derivative first. So now this is, I can bring r out, and it's a product rule, and so it's first times the derivative of the second, and we just, you know, we've already done that derivative, right, I think, so it's y over k times negative y to the negative 2 plus the second times the derivative of the first. I should have left myself more space. Let me see if I can fit that in here. So the derivative of the first, I already pulled the r out, so the derivative of the first is just 1. So it's, this is plus ln of k over y. And that's equal to 0. Everybody agree on that? Yes?
You forgot a k in your derivative of ln of k of y. When you do the derivative of the inside, the derivative of
k. That's right. Thank you. So there's a k here. Okay. So
So these k's will cancel, actually. So we get r y times negative. Now this is one over y squared, and then the times the y, so you get 1 over y. So 1 over y plus ln of k over y. I'm missing something.
What is, wouldn't it just be negative r?
No, why do you think that y?
I don't know. Let me think about this for a second. So the r, so first times the derivative. So I think what I was planning to do was something like this. And so we had first times the derivative of the second, which is k over. So y over k times the derivative of the inside, which is k negative y to the negative 2. So this is right. Plus the second times the derivative of the first, which is this. And
so you're thinking like extra parentheses
after the negative y. Yeah, but that's still not helping. Oh, there's two y's. That's right. So these guys cancel. Okay, good. So these. So what we get now is negative 1. Okay, well, that's solvable. Okay, good. This is gone. Okay. And then this is equal to 0. So then, so now ln k over y is equal to 1. Exponentiate both sides, so you get k over y is equal to e to the 1, which is equal to e. And so y is equal to, just switch these guys, so we get k over e. And e is just your exponential base, which is the 2.71 number. And so now we know that this maximum occurs at k over e, and therefore wherever k over e is, that's where you're going to have your inflection point. Okay? So without solving the differential equation, we're able to get a lot of information about the solution. And sometimes that's the best we can do. Any questions about this? Okay. And I wanted to do one more problem from 2.5. Actually, I feel like I want to do more. But so number 5... in 2.5, it's kind of an interesting problem. So this is a word problem. Consider a cylindrical water tank of constant cross section A. Water is pumped into the tank at a constant rate K and leaks out through a small hole of area little a in the bottom of the tank. So, okay, so I'm going to erase all this and we're going to draw this picture. Now, this one's asking us to construct the differential equation. And they give us some information. So the cylindrical tank, and there's some hole where we've got, it's leaking out at some rate, and it's being filled at some rate. And let's say this rate is K. going in, and the tank has a cross-sectional area it's constant cross-section A. Okay, so I'll put an A here. And through a small hole of area, little a, there, and from Torricelli's principle of hydrodynamics, which they actually derived this in an earlier section, it follows that the rate at which water flows through the hole is... alpha A times the square root of G 2GH. So this is alpha A times the square root of 2GH. That's that rate. Okay. And where H is the current depth of the water, G is acceleration due to gravity, and alpha is a contraction coefficient that satisfies this condition. It has to be between 0.5 and 1. Show that the depth of water in the tank at any time satisfies the following equation. Now, we can do a little bit better than that, but so... and we're just, it's just pure water, we're not diluting it, we don't have like salt in there or anything like that. So we can derive the differential equation, but that's what they're really asking us to do in the problem. They give us the differential equation and ask us to show that it is in fact the right one. So what's the first step?
Reading the area.
Yeah, so what? So D what? D by DT of what?
The alpha, this is
the volume of water.
The volume. Yeah, and what is the volume of water?
I mean, it would just be big A times H, right?
Yeah, so AH... and that's equal to what?
K minus alpha.
Exactly. K minus this thing. So K minus alpha A square root 2GH. Okay.
Why is it on this side we have the volume?
Well, because this is the flow rate, the amount of water coming in per unit time is K units. The amount of water going out per unit time is this. Those are measured in volumes. So we have to have a volume on the left side here.
I'm only confused because when we did the like the salt going out, we never had a volume on the other side.
Well, we were talking about the quantity of salt. And when we did use the volume, we were figuring out how much salt was coming out the bottom. Because we had to know how much water was in there. Because we knew a flow rate. We had a flow rate there. So volume wasn't implicitly implied. This is not the same problem, right? This is not the same as our salt problem. This is a different problem. Okay, are we done? So what's it asking us to show? Is this what we're asked to show? What's missing? What's wrong? What do we have left to do? You probably don't know what it's supposed to be. Okay, well, it turns out that this A is a constant. We're going to factor it out of the derivative and then divide both sides by it. So what we really want is dH dt is equal to K minus alpha A times the square root of 2GH all divided by A. And that is the differential equation that we're trying to solve. Or that they're asking us to write down. We don't actually have to solve it.
So you can just multiply the height by the difference.
Huh?
You can just multiply the height by the derivative pretty much and get dH dt.
I'm not multiplying by the height. This is the derivative of the height.
And references it.
It's not multiplication. These are not multiplying. It's a derivative. I factored out the a, and then I divided both sides by a, and so that's how I went from here to here. Yes.
And you're doing that just because the height is the one changing.
Yeah, because you'd have your dependent variable, and then now we're expressing the differential equation as a like an h prime equals something. Okay. Now notice there's an h over here, but there's no t. So this is a what kind of equation?
Separable.
It is separable. What else is it?
Autonomous.
That's right. So because it's separable, you can probably do the integral, or maybe the integral's frightening. I don't know. But again, we're not asked to solve the differential equation. Part B says, what is the equilibrium height? So how do we find the equilibrium height? Yes.
Set dH dt equal to zero.
Yeah. So set this equal to zero. So the derivative is zero. So the height's not going to change. Presumably, now there are going to be situations in the world where it's not going to asymptotically approach an equilibrium value. It might oscillate forever or something like that. But in this case. We'll see. We'll set the derivative equal to zero and see what happens. So multiply both sides by a, add the alpha term to the right, and so we get k is equal to alpha a square root 2gh. Now, we're solving for h in this problem for the equilibrium height. Once we have this equation, now there's no time dependence. This h has a very specific meaning. This isn't just h as a function of t. This is the equilibrium height of the water in the tank. So now divide both sides by alpha a. You get k over alpha a is equal to the square root of 2gh. Then I would square both sides, and you get 2gh is equal to k over alpha a quantity squared, and then divide both sides by 2g, and you get h is equal to 1 over 2g times k over alpha a quantity squared. And there's various ways you can write that, but that's fine as far as I'm concerned. So that's the equilibrium height of the water in the tank. Now, you know, there's a couple of things you can do to check to make sure that maybe one easy thing to do to check that this makes sense. Interestingly, it has nothing to do with the cross-sectional area of the tank. Notice that's not in the final answer. So big A doesn't have any effect. And it's like, well, does that make sense? I don't know. I mean, that depends on Torricelli's principle, I guess. The other thing is, it does depend on little a. Now, alpha and k and g are constants, but a, you can imagine changing that, right? One time I was trying to drain an above-ground pool, and I took a crowbar, and I just rammed it through the plastic siding of the pool. It was fun that day. And I won't say why I was doing that, but I just, I mean, I had to get rid of the pool. It was, I just bought the house, and there was this stupid pool in the back that was overgrown with mold and other things, and so the water's sitting there, and the creatures are in there, and so I just took a crowbar and lit into it. And so if you make a little hole, what's going to happen? It's going to take a long time to drain out. Then maybe that's a good thing, right? Otherwise you create like this ocean in your backyard, which is then going to go into your neighbor's backyard. And that can be a problem. So
But anyway, you try a little hole and you see what happens. It's like, oh, this is draining too slow. And then you gouge a bigger hole and suddenly it's rushing out. And so the point being, it's a real life experience. If you make a little A bigger, what's going to happen? It's going to drain faster. Now, what's that going to do to the equilibrium height?
It'll be lower.
It'll be lower because you're making A bigger, which is in the denominator. So that's going to lower the overall expression. Yes.
H is the equilibrium height.
Yes.
So why did you set this equal to zero again?
Here?
Yes.
This is because if it's equilibrium, it means that it's not changing. So it's, you've been pumping water in, and really what's happening is there's, it's, the Torricelli's principle says that the rate depends on age. In other words, you put a lot of water in, it's going to drain a little faster. You only have a little bit of water, it's going to drain a little slower. So that's why this H is here. And this A, same thing. If you make A big, then it's going to drain faster. If you make A small, it's going to drain slower. So there's some, it turns out that there is some equilibrium height for that tank. Wouldn't have to be the case, but it is in this particular problem. So anyway, a lot for engineers, a lot of the time what you're going to have are expressions of this type, and you may not know where they come from, but a lot of times they're equilibrium expressions. Yes?
How would it change if A wasn't at the bottom?
Well, if you put A up here, let's say, then this just becomes a stagnant pool of water, right? And then you're going to drain out until you get to that point, and that's not going to... So now your H is the distance above the drain spout. And I didn't say that before, but yeah, that H has to be the distance above the drain spout. Yes?
Does that equation imply that H can't be zero?
That's right. I mean, if all of these conditions are satisfied, there's no way that this expression is ever going to be zero. Okay. Which makes sense, right? Because you're pumping water in at a rate. And now it may be that Torricelli's principle is an approximation or something like that. And I think A is going to have to be small, if it's a big, giant cave, then, yeah, it's not going to work, but, yes?
Well, I'm also, and tell me if you think differently, but I'm also thinking that he's also counting the water in the tank regardless of whether it's flattened out or if it's draining out, so even if the bottom was completely gone, there's still technically water in the tank because the water is flowing through the tank.
You're saying the bottom is gone?
I'm saying even if you made A completely wide open and you have water constantly flowing in, then there is some volume of water in the tank before it exits out the giant hole in the bottom. Is that true?
If you make A infinitely large, which is probably what's happening here. Mm-hmm. If A is too big, then you're outside the bounds of where this approximation works. And then you're really making A huge, and then, of course, H is going to be zero, or something very close to zero. Yes, Hunter?
One question about the algebra. So when you had dt, dEdt, ah, equals that expression, how did you know to keep H and send A over to the other side?
Because
I could have done like dA, dt.
No, because A is not varying with respect to time.
So we have to know that. But we have to know that from the common
sense. A is a constant in the problem. So it's a... In fact, I think they use the word constant. It's constant cross-sectional area A. Or if not, I think you should assume that this tank is not changing size on you.
So the only reason we know that is because we look at your problem and from that we... No,
yeah, I mean, you're raising a very good point, and thank you for asking the question because, as I teach this stuff, certain things just seem obvious to me, and it's always the problem with the teacher with a student, right? I stand up here, I think you guys know certain things, and then I don't say them out loud,
and then there's misconceptions or gaps in the knowledge or whatever. Plus, I'm coming at this from a physics point of view. So I have I worked as an engineer for many years, and I have a physics undergrad, and you know, so some of these things just seem obvious to me. But you're right. So A is a constant, and H is the dependent variable. Now, if you're wondering, well, how do I know that H is the dependent variable? I look at the problem. In fact, they tell us what the differential equation is. They say, show that the depth of the water in the tank at any time satisfies the equation dH dt is equal to k minus alpha A times the square root of 2gh all divided by A. Well, that's exactly what I ended up with here. So I know the end goal in mind here. Yes?
Could it also be safe to assume that because A is a constant area, as stated in the problem, the cross-sectional area doesn't vary? And that H is being the depth of the water does change as water drains or is filled in, that would assume...
It will change until it reaches equilibrium.
But could we assume that because H is the variable that is changing, that therefore is the dependent variable?
No, because... in this case, I mean, T is changing too. In kind of a trivial way, time marches on, right? But just because something changes doesn't make it a dependent variable. You have to understand the causality of the problem. Think about the engineering or the physics aspects of it. Yes?
But time doesn't depend on anything. The height is what depends on as time goes on.
Well, if we solve the differential equation, there will be a time variable in there, and I could solve for time, and time would depend on H. So that what you're saying is not true. There's the inverse function. If I say, you know, the amount of money in your bank account is equal to CE to the RT, can I not solve for time and say that T depends on Y? I mean, we call this the dependent variable because Y depends on T, but T depends on Y too. This just happens to be a more useful way to think about it.
So the dependent variable depends on what question is being asked.
Yeah. Now, I think you guys are overthinking this a little bit. It's usually not going to be difficult to tell what's the dependent variable and what's the independent variable. And if there's any questions, you can ask. Yes.
Little a was safe. It was infinite. Water has viscosity here. So
that's the whole Torricelli principle. I mean, that's taking into account the viscosity and surface tension and whatever else. And then probably those values get absorbed into the alpha for water. There's probably, you know, alcohol is going to have a different alpha than water would have, say, for example. Okay, so, I mean, these are all very good questions, and I delight in all of this discussion, and really, it means that you're getting into the spirit of what we're trying to do with the differential equations course. A lot of what we're going to be doing in this course is taking physical situations and turning them into differential equations, and then extracting as much information from them as we can. So, I think if you're interested in this problem, you should go off and research Torricelli's principle, and you'll find a lot of information on that, and you'll know more than I know about it. I just have vague understanding of some of this stuff. Okay, so, yes? Question?
I was also going to say, also 5C. If you fire a rifle, the powder is solid, and then it becomes a gas, and then that expanding gas is what, so, you know, it's kind of like the same thing with that tank. You have the burning solid turning into gas, and then it's...
Well, I think there are certain similarities, and there are certain differences. I don't think PV is equal to NRT applies to this problem.
Yeah.
Not directly, anyway. But yeah, I take your meaning. the water is somehow filling the available space. Okay, so let's suspend discussion of this problem and move on. And if you have more questions about it, I'm perfectly happy to talk about this stuff either after class or before class. And that's always the case. Okay. So, section 2.6 is, it's called,
what is it called?
Exact equations and integrating factors. Now, we're already intimately familiar with integrating factors, but you may not know what an exact equation is. Now, I think either last time or the time before, I took a little survey to see how many of you were comfortable with partial derivatives. And there were about four people who weren't that comfortable with partial derivatives. And that doesn't mean you don't know them at all or that you can't do them. But I want to have a little bit of a discussion about partial derivatives because we're going to need that going forward. And this is the reason why, even though Calculus 2 is the prerequisite for this course, I think you might be better off if you've already had Calculus 3 for this one topic, for this one section. So, and again, if you don't worry about it. If you need to, come talk to me and I'll put you on the road to recovery when it comes to partial derivatives. We'll figure that stuff out. Okay, so, and those of you who have Calculus 3 or understand partial derivatives, I just want to do a simple example here. So partial with respect to x, and by the way, that symbol, that's called the partial symbol. It's also, some people call it the nabla. I don't know where that comes from, but it's a symbol. It's not a D. If you intend a partial differentiation, do not use the letter D. You must use the partial symbol. And let's say that we're taking the partial derivative of, let's say, x squared, y squared. And we're differentiating partially with respect to x. So what's the answer here? 2xy squared. Now, those of you who know partial derivatives know absolutely why that's true. Those of you who don't, let me just quickly explain. So when you take a partial derivative, it means that you're treating the other variable, and these have to be independent variables. So we're assuming that x is an independent variable and y is an independent variable. So presumably there's some function z which is some function of x and y. And so ordinary differentiation doesn't work on a function like that. That's why we always talk about partial derivatives, because you're only taking the derivative with respect to one of the independent variables. The other independent variable is treated as a constant. So y squared is a constant. And when you have it multiplying something, you can think of it as coming out of the derivative, or you can just leave it there. But the derivative, we're only taking the derivative with respect to x, so the derivative of x squared is 2x. And then this y squared is just some multiplying constant. Yes?
Do we need to include d plus a function of y?
Where would that go?
After the 2xy squared.
No, because we're not integrating.
Okay.
Yes?
So that was del v del x without, what would that look like?
What do you mean?
There's a y following that d looking symbol?
No, because if you say partial y, well, first of all, you wouldn't say partial y with respect to x. You'd say partial of z with respect to x. Or what I've done here is partial of this thing with respect to x. If I have partial z with respect to x, then I need to know what my z function is, and then I take the partial with respect to that. So in this case, this would be the dependent variable. Say z is equal to x squared
y squared.
And so we're taking the partial of z with respect to x. And so that's why, I mean, you wouldn't take the partial of y with respect to x, because y is a dependent variable in this case. Let's do another example. Suppose I take the partial with respect to y of 2xy plus e to the x. Yeah, so 2x is a constant with respect to y, and the derivative of y with respect to y is 1. So you get 1 times 2x, which is 2x, and then what's the derivative of the second term?
Zero.
Because e to the x does not depend on y, so the partial, so I can write the partial with respect to y of e to the x is equal to 0. Because e to the x is a constant with respect to y. Now, I don't want to turn this into a long lesson on partial derivatives. I just want to kind of give us a little flavor of it. So those of you who don't know partial derivatives can either ask later, or you can go home and study it, or, you know, whatever. But, and we're going to need some of these principles in order to be able to solve these problems. So I want to stop with the real basic stuff. Are there any questions about this? And by the way, if this didn't make any sense to you, come talk to me. Okay. Now, one place where we use partial derivatives sometimes is implicit differentiation. So suppose I've got, say I want to take, now this is an ordinary derivative, d by d x, of, say, x, what's my example? Actually, let me do it this way. So, let's suppose that I have an implicit function, which is x cubed y cubed is equal to c, where c is some constant. Now, here, because I have an equation, tell me what is the dependent variable?
C.
C is not a variable.
There,
there
isn't
one. Sure there is.
Why?
Y is the dependent variable, x is the independent variable. Do you remember about implicit functions? Throughout this course, we're going to have solutions of differential equations that are implicitly defined. Occasionally. So implicit means that this one I could solve for y, but there are situations where I can't solve the equation for y. And therefore, and in any case, this is an implicit representation of the function y as a function of x. We're assuming that somewhere in the universe there's this thing called y equals f of x. And in this case, I can solve for it, because y cubed is equal to c over x cubed, and take the cube root of both sides, so y is equal to the cube root of c over x cubed, or cube root of c over x, maybe. So in this particular case, I can solve for y, but that's not always going to be the case. If I have y e to the x minus ln y is equal to 5, there's no way that we can solve this equation for y. It's impossible. So, but there's still an implicit function defined. Y is a function of x. Okay, so how do we take the derivative? How do we find dy dx? Do you remember this from calculus 1? Please say yes.
Yes.
Yes, of course. Implicit differentiation. Remember that? We're going to have to do implicit differentiation in this course. Okay, so so I go d by dx of x cubed y cubed is equal to d by dx of c. What's d by dx of c? 0. And what's the left side? So first times the derivative of the second, which is what? 3y squared times what? dy dx. Plus second times the derivative of the first, which is 3x squared. And that's equal to 0. And now we can solve for dy dx. And so we get dy dx is equal to negative 3x squared y cubed divide by 3x cubed y squared. And we can simplify that. Okay, so that's dy dx for an implicit, for this particular implicit function. Now there's another way to get there, which is I can so any questions about this? I mean, this should be ringing all sorts of bells from calculus one. There's nothing mysterious about this. You need the chain rule, which is how I got this dy dx. Remember what implicit differentiation is and how to do it, and then solve for dy dx. It's just a little bit of algebra. Okay, so now there's another way to do this. So I'm going to assume that we have some, let me use uppercase F here, some function of x and y, and that's equal to some constant c. Now this method of solution is going to be based on partial derivatives. So how many of you here have had calc 3? Raise your hand high if you've had calc 3. Okay, raise your hand high if you have not had calc 3. Okay, well, you probably know enough, or will soon, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, about 5 of you. So, once you get to the chapter on partial derivatives, which I think is chapter 11 in Stewart, I can write down this. So df is equal to partial f with respect to x dx plus partial f with respect to y dy. And if I take the differential of both sides, so df is this, what's the differential of the constant?
You repeat that last part.
What's the differential of the constant?
Zero.
Okay. Now, notice, we can solve for dy dx. So if I subtract this from both sides, we get partial f with respect to y dy is equal to negative partial f with respect to x dx. And now divide both sides by the partial here, so we get, and divide both sides by dx, so you get dy dx is equal to negative partial f with respect to x divided by partial f with respect to y. Now, you might say, this seems harder than what we did over here, but usually it's easier to find the partial derivatives. So what's the partial? If I call this f of x comma y, what is the partial of f with respect to x? 3x squared y cubed. What is the partial of f with respect to y? So 3x cubed y squared. And now what this is telling me is that I can divide those and get the derivative dy dx. So negative 3x squared y cubed divided by 3x cubed y squared. And is that not exactly the same as what we got doing this? So once you understand partial derivatives and you go through this derivation once, we use this formula, we can find the implicit derivative dy dx. Now that's not something we're going to do a lot of, but knowing this and understanding this is going to help us understand how to handle exact differential equations. Because in order to do those problems, we're going to need to be able to do partial derivatives.
Okay? Any questions? By the way, I hate to have to say this, but the exact equations are in the syllabus. I have to cover that material in this course. So, we'll just make do. If you're having trouble with the partial derivatives, we'll figure it out. Okay. Any questions so far? Okay. So, what do I mean by an exact equation? Well, let me give you an example. Let's see. Okay, so here's an example. Let me go ahead and write this up here. Here's an equation, 3x squared y squared plus e to the y times y prime plus 2xy cubed minus 5x is equal to 0. Now, pretty soon we're going to know how to solve this differential equation. We have to first figure out whether it's exact or not. First thing I want to do, so at this point, it's in kind of a weird form. And if you suspect, so here's, let me say something that I said last time. One of the things that you're going to have to learn is not only the techniques, but when to apply the techniques. There's no guarantee that any particular technique is going to work on any particular problem. So you're going to operate on hunches and hope and a little prayer, perhaps, or whatever. But you look at this and you suspect, because of its form, that it might be exact. And if it's exact, then there's a procedure to go through to solve it. And that's what we're going to learn now. So I've got to put it in the right form. So I'm going to replace this y prime with dy dx. And I'm going to multiply both sides by dx. And I'm going to change the order a little bit. So I'm going to take this term here, these two terms, put them together. We're multiplying them by dx. So 2xy cubed minus 5x all times dx plus, and then now this dx is gone, 0 times dx is 0. So then it's this term in parentheses of that expression, 3x squared y squared plus e to the y times dy equals 0.
How did you do that?
I multiplied by dx, and I just I rewrote the equation. Which part are you not understanding?
Oh.
Yeah, you can multiply the whole thing by dx and cancel it from the left side.
Okay.
So this fraction goes away, but I end up with dx multiplying this guy.
And then dx times 0
is 0. Dx times 0 is 0. And so, and then I switch the order because I want the dx term here and the y term here. Okay, now I'm going to call this m. And I'm going to call this n. And this is very standard terminology, very standard notation. This is exactly how I learned it like 40-some years ago. And the first question we have to ask is this differential equation exact? Now, I'll be honest, I'm not sure why they call it exact. I mean, I think that what it means is that you can express it as a differential of some function, but I don't know why that makes it more exact than something that's not expressible in that way. It's a historical term. So when we talk about exact equations, what I'm about to tell you is how you determine whether it's exact or not. So if
partial m with respect to y is equal to partial n with respect to x, then the DEQ, the differential equation, is exact. Some of you may have seen this concept in other courses. Yes?
Didn't they present that in Cal 3?
Yes, it is in Cal 3. And if you know how to do the problem from Cal 3, then you already know this material.
Okay.
And so those of you who have taken Cal 3 have already seen this, probably, depending on your teacher, but you are supposed to cover it in Cal 3. In fact, this is one of the... We did it in Cal 3, and...
Last month.
This is that f sub x y is equal to
yes.
f sub y.
I'm not doing the theory now because I think that would just get us lost in the weeds. But I'm telling you procedurally how to do it, and it's described in the book. And if you have questions, you can come talk to me. But if you call this, so if it's written as something times dx plus something times dy is equal to zero, if you can reduce it to that form, and you label this as m and this as n, then it, and now notice that even though the m is attached to the dx, we're taking a partial with respect to y. And even though the n is attached to the dy, we're taking the partial with respect to x. And in case you, I'll just say one little word about the theory, mixed partials are equal. So those of you that had Calc 3 will know what I'm talking about. Okay, so...
So how do you get the dm
partial
m over the partial y?
You find it. So what's partial m with respect to y?
6xy.
So it's 6xy squared and the partial with respect to y of 5x is 0. What is the partial of n with respect to x? Same thing, 6xy squared. Now, although it is always true that mixed partials are equal, this is not always true for these equations. And if it's not true, if it turns out that these are different, then it means that your equation is not exact. And the technique that we're talking about here will not work. So you have to first ask the question, is the differential equation exact? And the way you answer that is by checking the partial derivatives, and if they're equal, then we can conclude, so this equation is exact. Now once we have that it's exact, then we have to find the solution. The solution of what? The solution of the differential equation. That's the next step. Okay. Questions so far? Now there's a lot going on here. And it can be confusing. You know, if I had to remember it from 40 some years ago, I probably wouldn't remember it. But because I teach it, I know it. And because you're the student in this class, you're going to know it too. After you've done a couple of the homework problems, you'll be fine. Okay, so now what I want to do is say, well, okay, how do we solve this thing? Well, probably helps if I give you a little bit of theory, but just a little, just a teeny bit. Suppose that there is some function such that if I take the differential of that function, that's equal to this. Well, if that's true, then it's exact. What this is saying is that there must be some function f, big F in this case, I'm calling it big F, so that if this condition is true, there is a differential of that function which is equal to this. And then all you have to do is figure out what f is. And that's what it, you'll see that that's what it means to solve this differential equation. Now, why is that? Well, because, let me write it down again, df is equal to partial f with respect to x dx plus partial f with respect to y dy. Notice, match this with this. And what do you see? Well, this part is going to be the partial of f with respect to x, and this is going to be the partial of f with respect to y. So let me write that down. So the partial of f with respect to x is equal to 2xy cubed minus 5x. And if we can do that, if we can solve for f in this problem, now, it won't be enough to do this. We've got to do it a little bit more. But if we can do this, then we're well on our way to getting f, which is the solution of the differential equation. You see, if we match this, which I'm giving you this on faith, right? You, if you haven't had Cal 3, you have to believe this is true. Even the people who took Cal 3 don't know why this is true. Is that a fair statement?
Yeah.
It's one of those things that the teacher writes down and says, thou shalt believe it or else. Okay? It's hard to derive. It's hard to prove. Trust me. If I thought I could prove it in 5 minutes, I would prove it. But it's not easy. Yes?
Didn't, and I might be going off on a tangent, please don't mind me. I think this is the combined change of x and y that summate to a combined
change. Your x and y are... independent variables, and this is the net change in the function. And if it were a plane, then you could even visualize it. What's the problem is when you have a surface, and then it's only true in the limit as dx and dy go to zero.
So this is tying back into like vector math.
Oh yeah, absolutely. I mean, some of you may have tried to figure this out, and if you have, great. But I'm just asking you to believe the formula for the moment. And so if this matches this, in other words, df is equal to partial of f with respect to x times dx plus partial of f with respect to y times dy. And if there is an f that has that property, if we can find that f, then we have solved the problem. And so this is one of the conditions. Partial of f with respect to x is the first factor. And it turns out also that partial of f with respect to y is the second factor, which is 3x squared y squared plus e to the y. Now, there are two ways to do this problem, and I always do it a particular way, but I think this time I'm going to try the other way, just to be adventurous, okay? What we might call method one and method two, and I don't care how you do it as long as you get the right answer. But so I'm going to multiply both sides by the partial x. Now, that's formally, it's a little weird, because that really doesn't have an algebraic identity apart from this partial f, but I'm going to do it anyway. So partial f is equal to 2xy cubed minus 5x all times partial x. What that's really saying is that you're integrating with respect to x. So therefore f is equal to the integral of 2xy cubed minus 5x partial x. Now this is not a dx, it's a partial x. But the integration pretty much works the same way, except that how do you treat y?
Constant.
Y is a constant. So this is going to be an easy integral. So the first term you get 2x squared over 2, which is x squared y cubed minus, and then 5x squared over 2 plus, now because you have, you're integrating with respect to x, it's possible that you have a function of y sitting out there. So I'm going to call this plus c of y.
The reason is if you took the derivative, the partial derivative with respect to x, the c of y would go away, and you get back what you started with, this thing right here. So in general, just like you normally have a constant here, this constant of integration actually has to be a function of y. Now here, we're going to do the same thing. We're going to multiply both sides by nabla y, or whatever that thing is, and call this thing partial f is equal to 3x squared y squared plus e to the y, nabla y. Does that, do you like that word?
Nabla.
It'll work. I don't know. If other people hear me say that, they'd be like, what the hell are you talking about? But, okay, or just a partial y, that works too. And then we integrate, so f is equal to the integral of 3x squared y squared plus e to the y, nabla y, partial y. And now we're going to integrate, so we get f is equal to the first term. Now we're integrating with respect to y, so you get the 3x squared, but you get a y cubed over 3. The 3's cancel, so you get x squared y cubed. And that's the first term. And then what's the integral of e to the y? Just e to the y. So plus e to the y plus now some constant with respect to x, because this was an integral with respect to y. Now, match them up. And what has to happen is f is equal to, now notice these are the same. So you get x squared y cubed. You get a minus 5x squared over 2. You get a plus e to the y. And then you get a plus some actual constant. Now, this is equal to 0. Or actually, well, it's equal to some constant. So now what we can do, make sure I'm doing this. Yeah, so I did that right. So I can put this constant on the other side. So it was 0, but I'm going to say this is equal to a constant. And now this is an implicit representation of our solution. Because what should it be? It should be y is a function of x. Even though in solving the problem we treated x and y as both independent variables, now we come back and we think, okay, we were really solving this differential equation, which, you know, for y, and so y is some function of x, and so now this is an implicit representation of our solution. And if you can graph this using graphing software, your graphing calculator probably won't be able to do this, but like Mathematica can graph this, and it will be a curve in the plane, depending on your value of c. Yes?
So, you just combine the two,
uh-huh.
When it's like comes, you don't do like...
Take a superset.
You just make it into one.
Yeah, so the union of the terms, removing any common terms, you know, you only need one of them.
Always equals c?
Yep.
Or equals zero, and then you just take...
Yeah, I just move my arbitrary constant over. It's arbitrary, so it doesn't matter whether it's
minus
or plus. And so... Yeah, now, this, think of this as your initial condition constant. So even though you don't have this explicitly solved for y, it's not an explicit function, it's an implicit function, but you can take your initial condition and the x naught you plug in your y naught, and you can calculate, get your c, and then that becomes, you replace the c with the number that you get, and that becomes the solution of the differential equation. Now, how do I know that it will work? Well, if you differentiate both sides with respect to x and do the implicit derivative, it should give you back this equation. So you should try that. Okay? How you doing? You guys freaking out yet?
Yes.
So why would it be two, the
X? No, I don't count them twice. Did I make a mistake in the 2? Because if I'm integrating with respect to x, you're going to get x squared over 2.
Right, but why?
And then the 2's cancel.
But why don't you count both of them?
Because I just want a function such that when I do the partial with respect to x, I get an x squared y cubed. And when I do a partial with respect to y, I get an x squared y cubed. If you want... Well, I don't think you can just arbitrarily multiply it by some constant, but... Huh?
So you're not just adding them together, you're just...
No, I'm not adding them together at all. No, they're not being added together. I'm looking for the best solution that satisfies both conditions. Yes?
How do you get back to the original equation?
Take the derivative with respect to x of both sides and solve for dy dx. In other words, this is an implicit function. Remember what we did at the very beginning? We took the implicit derivative of something and we solved for dy dx. And if you can even use that formula that we came up with, which is dy dx is equal to negative partial with respect to x divided by partial with respect to y. Yes?
So if one of them was not x squared y cubed, you would just add that into the equation?
Yeah. If, I mean, whatever terms are... extra, add them in. Now, another way to do it is, and I'm not going to have time to demonstrate it right now, but once I have this, then I can go back and I take the partial with respect to y, and then you're going to get a c prime of y, and you can set that equal to this. And you'll see the terms cancel, and that gives you the final answer. And if that's not clear, it will hopefully be in when you do the homework. Other questions? These are all good questions. I'm going to do one more. This one's going to be hopefully shorter. We don't have that much time left. So I'm erasing this. Okay, so 2x squared yy prime. Is equal to 2xy squared. Is that exact? Now, nobody expects you to be able to answer that question off the top of your head. What do you have to do? You have to put it into the right form. So it's got to be something, you know, m dx plus n dy is equal to 0. So I suspect that there's a possibility that this is exact. So let me replace the y prime with dy dx. This is, people sometimes ask, well, why do you not like the prime notation? Well, because the prime notation doesn't tell you what to do in a situation like this. So I replace this with dy dx. So you get 2x squared y dy dx equals 2xy squared. And now I'm going to multiply both sides by dx. And so you get 2x squared y dy is equal to 2xy squared dx. Now what's the next step? Subtract this term from both sides. Okay, so you get negative 2xy squared dx plus 2x squared y dy is equal to 0.
Can't we just take the integral like a separable?
Because that's not the question. I mean, what is the question?
Is it exact?
Is it exact? I mean, obviously, if I were trying to solve this equation, you know, for real, I would separate variables and integrate, and it would not be a hard problem, right? But we have to get good at solving exact equations, and the best way to do that is with simple problems, and then when the problems become more complicated, you'll know what to do. So, Avoid the temptation. If someone says, here's an exact equation, or find out if this is exact, go ahead and, you know, get in the spirit of it. You know, you want to get good at being solving exact equations. And so, okay, so is it exact? So this is your M. This is your N. So how do we test? Partial M with respect to Y is equal to partial N with respect to X. What's the partial of N with respect to X? 4XY. What's the partial of M with respect to Y? Negative 4XY. Yeah, so exact or not? Not exact. And, you know, these minus signs will catch you. If you think, oh, well, this, you know, at this point, if you label this N and this M, and you check to see, you're tempted to think that they are, that the partials are equal, but they're not, because you haven't got it in the right form. So this is the right form, and when we do the test on the correct form, we see that it's not exact. So what does that mean? Well, we have to find some other way to solve it. Yes?
Will it not turn negative when you move it to the other side?
Yeah, it will be positive if you move it to the other side, but that still doesn't change the fact that it's not exact.
What I'm saying is, wouldn't the sign be saying if you move it to the other side?
Yeah, that's what I'm saying. That's how we started, right?
So it'd be 4XY. 4XY.
Yeah, this is 4XY and 4XY. Are those equal? Yeah, but it's not the right form. So okay, it has to be MDX plus NDY is equal to 0. You don't get to have them on the other side of the equation. Okay?
And then, so what I'm asking is that when you put the equal, you don't move one to the other side and then say that.
I took this equation, which was given, and I put it into the correct form.
Okay.
And
you just take it. Okay.
Yeah. I know you guys are in a hurry, but I still have 30 seconds. We get out 7:45. Not 7:40. Is it 7:40? I mean, is it? We get out at 7:45, right? Well, I'll apply that rule on the day of the exam. No, I won't do that. No, I think we do go until 7:45. It's fine. You know, I'd be anxious to get out of here too. Okay. You guys are free to go. So have a good weekend. If you haven't turned in your homework, please do that before you leave.
Okay. So, you want me to just hold the...
Anything that was due last week is no longer going to be accepted.
Hold on to it.
Well, you got to get all the results before the test.
Yes, sir. And I told him that. He said it takes 45 minutes to come in, and I always say,
The thing is, I have to get the test at the Testing Center, and I can't do that on the day of the exam.
Right. But that was on Monday, and beforehand.
Okay. Thank you.
Pile.
Perfect. Thank you. I think most of the problems have the answers in the back of the book. So you should be able to check your own answers.
Yeah.
Right. And I'm not going to grade it for correctness. That's not how it works.
Oh.
So and just read the syllabus for the homework policy.
Oh.